Night. However, before we come to introducing the speaker, I'm going to introduce Andrea Salamandris from the Holding Redlich law firm. Holding Redlich has had a very long relationship with the Caston Centre, and it's through through such relationships that we've been able to bring out such distinguished speakers as the one we have tonight. So, so please let me let us welcome Andrea to welcome our speaker.
I, like Sarah, will speak for a very short time because at Holding Redlich today we had the pleasure and, of listening to Justice Goldstein, and let me assure you all, you're all in for a good hour ahead. He's a wonderful speaker. His resume is really quite something. I'm sure we'll all listen to this with quite envy and absolute respect. From 1991 to 1994, he was the chairperson of the Commission of Inquiry regarding public violence and intimidation. Following that, he was then the Chief Prosecutor for the United Nations International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. He then returned to South Africa, where he was a Justice of the Constitutional Court. He's been awarded numerous international prizes in human rights law, and for the last 5 years has been lecturing at numerous universities throughout America. But as I said, I will keep it short because he's the star of the day, so I'll pass over to him now. Thank you.
Well, good evening. It's a great pleasure to be back in Melbourne. I'm happy to say this is my third visit to Melbourne, and I've enjoyed it more each time. It's a particularly good week, a good day to be discussing the problems and prospects for international criminal justice. This year will mark the 60th anniversary of the Geneva Conventions of 1949. At the end of last month, the first trial before the International Criminal Court began, and I'll come back to that. Today saw the first day of proceedings before the Lebanon Tribunal, which sits in the Netherlands. And tomorrow, the judges, a pretrial chamber of the International Criminal Court, will hand down its decision on whether to order the arrest of President al-Bashir, the president of the Sudan. And the prospects, I think, are almost overwhelming that they will order such an arrest warrant to be issued. So there's a lot going on in the field of international criminal justice very soon after it was born. And let me spend a few minutes tracing the really very exciting history of a new era and a new branch of the law, of international law in particular, namely international criminal justice. It was really born in 1949 with Nuremberg. Before Nuremberg, there was no such thing as international criminal justice. Human beings were not the subjects at all of any branch of international law. Only nations were recognized by international law. Only nations had standing to use international law. And by the same token, there was no such thing as international human rights law. People were dependent solely for the protection of their human rights in the few democracies that recognized them and provided courts to enforce them. And there weren't many of those. How nations treated their own people in those days was a purely internal affair. I certainly remember in my student days and after, South Africa, with justification, turned around to the world and said, mind your own business. The way we treat our people is not the business of the international community. It's an internal affair. That fortunately has changed radically in more recent decades. Universal jurisdiction, which today is being used more and more, also didn't exist. There was no such thing as universal jurisdiction, a jurisdiction which domestic courts had to try crimes, to try criminals for crimes committed outside their countries. It existed indeed only for pirates. Piracy traditionally for centuries has attracted universal jurisdiction, and out of necessity. If all courts couldn't try pirates, there'd be no courts that could try pirates because they didn't commit their offences within the geographical boundaries of any country. It was on the high seas, and it would be difficult to bring pirates to justice if there wasn't universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction has broadened considerably, mainly again as a result of Nuremberg, because for the purpose of putting the Nazi leaders on trial, the Allied powers, the four victorious powers after the Second World War, in setting up the Nuremberg tribunals, created a new crime which they called crimes against humanity. The phrase wasn't brand new, but the crime was. And the idea was that some crimes are so huge, so egregious, and so horrifying that they're crimes not only against the victims, the immediate victims, not even crimes against the people of the country in which they committed, but truly crimes against all of humankind, crimes against humanity. And as such, people in any country have the right to bring those people to justice because they're crimes committed against all people, and thereby any people have the right to bring them to their courts. And the idea was that crimes against humanity and universal jurisdiction would be recognized for what are today more and more commonly being called atrocity crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, huge war crimes. And one sees that universal jurisdiction reflected in the Geneva Convention 60 years ago. They were the first international conventions to recognize universal jurisdiction for the most serious violations of the Geneva Conventions, called the grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, the worst kinds of war crimes, which are amenable to the justice of any court anywhere. The Geneva Conventions say explicitly that any government is obliged to investigate and bring to justice any person suspected of committing a grave breach of those conventions, no matter where committed. So if a grave breach is alleged to be committed in Iraq, the courts of Australia under the Geneva Conventions have the jurisdiction, subject obviously to domestic legislation, and many countries have that. And the conventions go further and provide if any particular country where the defendant happens to be found, where the alleged criminal happens to be found, is unable or unwilling to bring that person to court, they have an obligation to hand him or her to a country that is willing and able to charge them. So here is universal jurisdiction. The second international convention to recognize universal jurisdiction was the 1973 United Nations International Convention that held apartheid in South Africa to be a crime against humanity. The closing of a little circle there, and it provided universal jurisdiction. Unfortunately, in my view, the convention was never applied in certainly its criminal provisions, and no prosecution ever ensued under the Apartheid Convention against any South African apartheid leader. Had it been used seriously, I have little doubt that apartheid might well have come to an end at least a decade before it did. So we see these two new planks on which international criminal justice has been relying, recognizing individuals as having as being amenable to courts for international crimes, for atrocity crimes, and also the use of universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction was recognized in the Torture Convention. The Torture Convention confers universal jurisdiction for all violations of that convention, and of course, in the last 15 or 20 years, universal jurisdiction is recognized in about 13 international conventions trying to combat terrorism. And it's important in the area of terrorism that there should be universal jurisdiction so that terrorists shouldn't be able to find sanctuaries in any countries because their courts might otherwise lack jurisdiction. The third development of importance in this area has been the growth of international human rights. As I said, there was no such thing, certainly before the Second World War, and one sees it first recognized in the Charter of the United Nations, which, as one of the founding principles in Article 1.3 of the Charter, requires member states, all members of the United Nations, to show, quote, respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms for all without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. Unfortunately, I need hardly add that there are many countries that don't take that founding principle of the United Nations seriously enough, or in the case of some countries, at all. The 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, while intended to inspire rather than bind nations, spawned major international human rights conventions in the 1960s, and in particular the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Social and Cultural Rights, and others, international conventions recognizing gender equality, and in more recent years, the rights of the child. But the Convention on Political Rights required state parties, and most members of the United Nations have ratified that convention, it required them to protect the fundamental rights of their citizens. In the immediate post-World War II year, there was a demarcation made. In times of peace, the International Convention applied. In times of war, the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war applied. And when there was a war, human rights laws were, as it were, put in abeyance. They were suspended. But that's been changing, too, in more recent years. And there has been a greater convergence between human rights law, international human rights law, and the law of war, international humanitarian law. That was recognized by the International Court of Justice in 1996 when it gave its advisory opinion at the request of the General Assembly of the United Nations on the legality of the threat of use of nuclear weapons. And the International Court of Justice had to deal with an argument that was put up by some member states who argued that the International Convention on Political and on Civil and Political Rights was directed, as I've said, to the protection of human rights in times of peace, and that questions of unlawful loss of life and hostilities was governed only by the law applicable in armed conflicts. And the court said that isn't correct. They said that under the International Convention, certain rights are derogable. But one of them that cannot be derogated from is the right to life. And they said even in times of war, the right to life remains binding and, as it were, sacrosanct. That was taken further in the later opinion of the court dealing with the legal consequences of the construction of a wall in the occupied Palestinian territory, a decision of 2004. So it's on that basis that it's now generally accepted that the right to life certainly remains alive and enforceable even in time of war. And as the International Court of Justice said, that during war, when life can be taken, is obviously governed by the law of war, not by international human rights law, but it cannot be derogated from in its entirety. So there were all these developments which came together in modern international criminal law. The problem, of course, until 1993, was that there was no court in existence anywhere in the world that could enforce that law. If domestic courts refused to, that was it. There was no further appeal. There was no international or regional court to which anybody whose rights were being denied, whose rights were being violated, could turn for any justice. Domestic courts very seldom use these laws, because unfortunately, in most countries, evil leaders are seen as heroes and not war villains. And domestic courts do not frequently put their own war criminals on trial. Obviously, the Nuremberg trials made many people think about and assume that there would soon after Nuremberg be a permanent international criminal court set up by treaty. And indeed, if one looks at the Genocide Convention of 1948, you will see in Article 6 of that convention that it states that the crime of genocide shall be amenable to domestic courts in countries where genocide is committed, or, I quote, to an international court having jurisdiction. It was assumed that there would be such an international court. The Apartheid Convention, to which I referred, has a similar provision, saying that the crime of apartheid may be brought home in an international court having jurisdiction. And it was the Cold War that ensued almost immediately after Nuremberg that really put this whole endeavor to sleep for almost 50 years. And although there were attempts at the United Nations to start drafting rules for a permanent international court, it really came to nothing. And the first breakthrough was the establishment in 1993, in May of 1993, of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And that came about, as all of these things do, for political reasons. Horror stories were coming out of the former Yugoslavia of torture and murder and systematic mass rape of women as a means of making war, particularly on the Muslim population of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And under huge pressure from human rights organizations and from victims, particularly in Europe, the European nations, with the support of the United States and Canada in particular, decided to get the Security Council to set up the first ever truly international criminal court, the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia. And it was given as its remit, as its jurisdiction, four areas of crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, and violations of the customary laws of war going back to the Hague Conventions of the end of the 19th century. So this was a most unexpected and in many ways courageous decision by a unanimous Security Council in 1993. What had made the difference, of course, was that in 1989 the Berlin Wall fell, the Cold War came to an end, the Soviet Empire broke up, and the opposition from that quarter was muted, because certainly during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, and China for that matter, would have strenuously opposed any international criminal court. In 1993, there was this window of opportunity. There were the atrocities. There was a CNN factor that broadcast well-known photographs of emaciated men with their bones coming through their skin in a concentration camp in Bosnia, in the Amarska region of Bosnia, that was reminiscent of scenes from the Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. And that was the inspiration for setting up the Yugoslavia Tribunal by the Security Council. It wasn't treaty-based. It was the Security Council using its peremptory binding powers under the United Nations Charter that deals with breaches of the peace, that enable the Security Council to take extraordinary action where there's determined by it to be a threat to international peace and security. It was mainly the United States that led the movement to Nuremberg. Without the United States push, Winston Churchill would have almost certainly got his way. He didn't want Nuremberg trials. He wanted to summarily execute the German leaders. It was mainly the United States of America that insisted on a trial, and Churchill gave way. And it was mainly the United States that was responsible for setting up the Yugoslavia tribunal, and in the following year, 1994, the International Tribunal for Rwanda. Now, there are many positive legacies from the two United Nations ad hoc tribunals. Let me just briefly mention three. The one is that they established for the first time that international courts could work. It was by no means a given. Many, many well-intentioned people thought that, you know, is it possible to have a fair trial put on by a court with judges from 11 different countries, prosecutors from 40 countries, investigators from 40, 50 countries, could they really work together with common law systems and civil law systems and Russian law systems and Chinese systems? Could they really work together and put on fair trials? And that has been well established, and there are really no serious allegations that I've read or heard suggesting that the trials before these international criminal courts have been unfair or substantially unfair. So that was an important breakthrough. The second was the development of the law, because until the Yugoslavia Tribunal, the laws to which I've referred, Genocide Convention, War Crimes, Geneva Convention, had hardly ever been used. And one need hardly state the obvious, that if laws are not used, they don't develop. They become petrified. They become the subject of academic teaching and research, and have no practical effort. The most graphic and most important example of that, in my view, is the way the international criminal tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda fashioned and developed the law dealing with gender-related crimes, and especially systematic mass rape, but enforced prostitution, enforced pregnancies, horrible crimes that were committed against women in war for centuries, but never recognized by international criminal law. The Geneva Conventions talks about the murder and torture and other crimes. So too do does the Genocide Convention. No reference to rape as a war crime. And the reason I would suggest is that the laws of war were written by men for men. And there was a complete ignoring of the terrible crimes that have been committed against women over the centuries, whether it was in the Second World War and going back in history. And it struck me, as the first chief prosecutor for both Yugoslavia and Rwanda, that in the same period, in wars in Africa and in Europe, rape was being used as a means of making war. And the tribunal, the prosecutors, and the judges started using the law they were given, cruel and inhuman punishment, cruel and inhumane conduct, as rape. In certain cases, torture was used for charging rape. And the law developed apace in that regard. And if you look today at the statute for the Permanent International Criminal Court, you will see gender crimes are dealt with very fully. All of these areas have now become part of accepted international criminal law. The third success development of that came from the two ad hoc tribunals was the effective ending of impunity for heads of state. And that's had a tremendous effect. So these were unanticipated, but I think very, very positive developments. They also had a knock-on effect, and local domestic courts in various countries started themselves using universal jurisdiction, some inappropriately. Belgium, I think, overreacted and overstepped the mark by wanting to set its own courts up as international criminal courts, and issuing indictments against people who had nothing to do with Belgium. Well, probably better than nothing, but not an ideal situation. But importantly, the withdrawal of impunity had an effect that really came to a head with the arrest in London at London Clinic at the end of 1998 of General Pinochet. He was there not for the first time for medical treatment. His great friend Margaret Thatcher looked after him rather well. And the Spanish judge, using the torture convention, applied for a warrant of arrest and extradition of General Pinochet, the former head of Chile, former president of Chile. Well, not she wasn't president; he was the military leader of Chile for torture committed against people who were then in Spain 20 years before. Now, professors of international law wouldn't have even suggested that as an examination question. It would have been regarded as a little absurd that a Spanish judge could have Pinochet arrested in London for crimes committed in Chile 20 years before. But that's exactly what happened. And although Pinochet was eventually returned by the UK to his home country, Chile, because of his ill health, it had a huge effect in Chile. The amnesty he granted himself was withdrawn by the Chileans. He was charged with all sorts of frauds and torture in his own country, and died a very unhappy old man before he was able to face trial. But that had its own knock-on effects. And there are many examples. Harold Mariam Mengistu, the former dictator of Ethiopia, was sought by his own country for genocide. He escaped, and inappropriately, but not surprisingly, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe gave him asylum, and he's been living very happily in somewhere in Zimbabwe. But he came to Johannesburg in South Africa for an operation, and a Human Rights Watch in New York came to hear about it, set up a hue and cry, and Mengistu had to scuttle back to Zimbabwe and make do with their medical treatment because he feared being arrested and put on trial in South Africa. A similar incident happened with the former head of Malaysia, of Indonesia, President Suharto, who also liked getting medical treatment in a German clinic. He got wind of an international warrant of arrest being issued by a German court, and he cancelled his medical treatment. It's remarkable how these oppressive leaders who tortured their people usually seem to want the best medical treatment for themselves. And they're finding it much more difficult than they used to in getting it. The result, too, is that right now, today, we have two former heads of state, one self-appointed and one legally appointed. Charles Taylor of Liberia is standing trial before the Sierra Leone Tribunal in The Hague, and Radovan Karadzic, the self-proclaimed president of Republika Srpska, the Serb enclave in Bosnia, is also, in fact, also today having to plead to an amended charge against him, which includes two charges of genocide. So there were these huge, exciting, rapid developments, and those successes enabled the move towards having a permanent international criminal court that was set up, or certainly the statute was approved by 120 nations in favour, including, I'm happy to say, both South Africa and Australia, against the opposition of the United States and six other countries. And that court began to function. A very high threshold was created. The Rome Statute of 1998 said that the court would not begin its work. The treaty would not be triggered into operation until 60 nations had joined. It was a huge, very high threshold. Never before had an international convention required as many as 60 nations. It's been 15, it's been 20, it's never been 60. And many, many supporters of the court, many optimists thought, well, if it takes 10 years, that's pretty good. It took less than four, because in April of 2002, the 60th ratification came in, and the court began its life on the 1st of July of 2002. Since then, there have been another 48 ratifications, and today it stands at 108. I'm happy to say that the region with the most ratifications is Africa. 30 African countries out of 53 members of the African Union have ratified, followed by 27 from the European Union, which includes every member of the European Union save one, the Czech Republic. What the reason is for their reticence, I'm not sure. I doubt if it's any principled objection. It could well be that they've been slow in getting local legislation before ratification. Australia was one of the earliest countries to ratify and one of the earliest countries to pass in 2002 its own legislation to domesticate the crimes referred to in the Rome Statute. Today, there are four cases before the International Criminal Court, four situations, four countries, all in Africa. The first was Uganda, then followed by the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Central African Republic, and most recently the Darfur situation in the Sudan. Now, there's been some misguided criticism of the court in some African quarters, suggesting that the fact that the four situations before the court are from Africa, that there's some anti-African bias in the court. Well, of course, that's nonsense, because three of the four were referred by African governments: Uganda, Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of the Congo. All their governments requested the court to investigate the situations of war crimes in their country. So it wasn't as though the prosecutor went out and on his own initiative started investigating. And the fourth, in the case of Darfur, was in fact referred to the International Criminal Court by the Security Council of the United Nations, acting under powers conferred upon it by the Rome Treaty. The first trial, as I mentioned earlier, began in the last 3 weeks, the trial of Lubanga Dyilo, who is facing charges of conscripting huge numbers of child soldiers. Really a most horrible crime that's become too common, of children as young as 10 and 11 being forced to bear arms and to participate as soldiers in wars, particularly, but not only in Africa. The International Criminal Court is going through its teething stage. It's really a very new organization when you think it began with the appointment of the prosecutor in September of 2002. He had to set up an office, judges had to be appointed. There are a lot of innovations that are brand new in the International Criminal Court, and particularly the representation of victims. Victims have the right under the Rome Statute to be represented. And the court has gone very far in saying they have a right to be represented not only at the trial stage, but even at the investigation stage. And this has given rise to a lot of problems. And the judges are slowly but surely finding their way through a thicket of problems that have arisen as a result of many, many hundreds of victims applying to intervene in cases. And of course, there's a problem here, because it's one thing for an accused person to have to deal with a prosecutor and to be opposed by the prosecutor. The victims are now not only having to deal with counsel appearing for the prosecutor, but also counsel dealing for the victims. And that, of course, complicates the whole position. And the judges are going to, and already cognizant of the fact that they have to be careful to ensure that the rights of victims don't interfere with the fairness of trials against accused people. And keeping that balance is a matter that's very much present in the interlocutory applications that have been brought before the International Criminal Court. So that's all the good news. The bad news and the problems arise obviously from questions of sovereignty. No international court can, or in the lifetime of anybody in this room, no international criminal court is going to have its own police force. No international criminal court is going to have its own army. It's completely and will remain completely reliant on governments to support its orders. If it orders the arrest of people, governments where those people are going to have to execute those arrest warrants. There's nothing the court can do itself to enforce its own orders. And that's, of course, a cardinal difference between domestic courts, where there is a police force and an army, if necessary, can be called out to go and arrest people. There is no such equivalent in the international arena. So it's politics. And whether the court's orders are executed or respected is a matter of political will and political weakness in many ways. In the case, take Milosevic, the former head of state of Serbia and Montenegro. When he was indicted, the prospect of him ever being arrested were zero. People said he will never be arrested. He's not a big traveler. He wasn't a big traveler. He was happy with his home with his homegrown clinics, and he didn't go travelling, and he felt secure, and he didn't take seriously the arrest warrants that were issued against him. Little did he know, little did any of us know, that within a very few years there'd be a revolution in Serbia, and that his successor, Djindjic, who unfortunately himself was assassinated, nobody anticipated that Djindjic would bundle Milosevic into an aeroplane and have him sent off for trial in The Hague. Of course, unfortunately, Milosevic died before the trial came to an end, but he met his death perhaps not inappropriately in a prison cell in The Hague. So one never knows. Of course, it was the United States' economic might that led Djindjic to send Milosevic, because the United States said, if you don't send him, we're going to refuse you the more than $1 billion of aid that you'll get if you do send him. So there were a billion good reasons for sending Milosevic. And similarly, senior Croatian generals wouldn't have ended up in The Hague, including General Gotovina, who's on trial at the moment, if the United States hadn't made similar threats. The problem facing the International Criminal Court is it hasn't had the support of the United States. That's crucially important. With the United States' political and economic muscle, it can make, and certainly for the other tribunals, made the difference. And certainly during my period of office in The Hague and for the Rwanda Tribunal, I saw it firsthand how important that support from the United States and from some European countries, how important that was. That's changing now, fortunately. In the last 2 years of the Bush administration, the attitude of the United States began to change to the International Criminal Court from being strongly and absolutely against it and determined to undermine it and to smash it, which was the first 6 years of President Bush. It started changing three years ago, when the Bush administration decided not to veto the reference of the Darfur situation to the International Criminal Court. I was surprised when I was participating in a panel in Washington, D.C. in May of last year, when the legal advisor to the State Department stated publicly on a panel that the State Department had offered assistance to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court in cases which were not inconsistent with American foreign policy. It was a complete 180-degree change. And of course, President Obama has indicated a very different attitude of support for the International Criminal Court, and his new ambassador at the United Nations, Susan Rice, has for some years been an outspoken supporter of the International Criminal Court. So I think one can see that one can anticipate a much friendlier attitude from the United States. I can't see ratification. I think that's some way down the line. But that doesn't matter as much as support for the court and the United States using its influence to assist the court and to persuade governments to comply with orders of the International Criminal Court. The indictment, and let me end with a couple of references to tomorrow's event. If, as I anticipate, and I anticipate it because it leaked, the judges of the International Criminal Court decided to give the United Nations Secretary General advance notice that they were going to order the arrest of a head of state, a sitting head of state, Bashir, and that leaked out. I mean, if you want to get universal publicity for anything, tell it in confidence to somebody at the United Nations. that the absolute assurance. And it leaked out about 2 weeks ago. The court issued statements saying it wasn't correct, that no announcement has been made. They didn't say it wouldn't be, but they gave notice last week that the decision will be made known tomorrow morning in The Hague. And the effect will be interesting, because it will mean that President Bashir will stand to be arrested if he sets foot in any of the member countries, the 108 countries that have ratified the Rome Treaty, and that, of course, is a serious handicap for any head of state. Can't go to Europe, can't go to meetings in Europe. The African Union and a number of African countries, unfortunately my own included, have objected ahead of time to the arrest of a head of state. They didn't object when it was Milosevic, a European head of state. They didn't object when it was people lower down in Sudan, because two other members of the Sudanese government have been indicted. Arrest warrants have been issued. They didn't get too excited, but because it's a head of state, they, I think, get a little bit uncomfortable. It's a little bit too close to home, and the African Union has requested the Security Council to suspend the proceedings against President Bashir. I'm happy to say it hasn't worked, and it's ironic that it's mainly opposition from the United States that has blocked it. But the European members of the Security Council, the permanent members, France and the UK, have been a bit ambivalent, but they are now coming down strongly on the side of the International Criminal Court, and I don't believe that there's going to be any interference by the Security Council. That will be interesting to watch from tomorrow. Already, in anticipation, I saw on the internet this afternoon that in anticipation of tomorrow's announcement, there are placards all over Khartoum saying that President Bashir is the savior of the Sudanese people, and saying what a great guy he is, and saying terrible things about the prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo. So I don't think they will be surprised if the arrest warrant is issued. In short and in conclusion, if the democratic nations of the world, particularly under leadership of the United States, wish the International Criminal Court to work, it can. What is needed is leadership and political will. And I'm optimistic, as I've already indicated, that the United States is resuming that critical leadership. And under that leadership, international criminal justice will begin to work more efficiently. When that happens, I certainly hope that there will be a greater chance for this new century, the 21st century, to be a lot less bloody than the last. Thank you. In the United States? Well, you know, I'm strongly in favor of all investigations into criminality. And certainly, let me say two things. Firstly, the any crimes that may have been committed during the period of the Bush administration are certainly don't even approach crimes of the seriousness that would attract the attention of an international criminal court. It just doesn't get there, and for that reason, for that and other reasons, the prosecutor has refused to look into those sorts of allegations. But having said that, I think it's important for the American people to know what happened. There's been a lot of secrecy during the Bush administration. What's happened at Guantanamo hasn't really surfaced sufficiently. But I'm involved on the board of Physicians for Human Rights, which is a Boston-based medical-driven human rights organization. And they interviewed 14 former Guantanamo detainees who gave horror stories about being tortured. And the physicians, senior leading American physicians, examined them and found objective evidence to support the allegations they made. And if you're interested, you can find it very quickly by Googling Physicians for Human Rights, and you'll find the report on their website. It's quite a long, detailed report. And of course, there've been other stories, the Abu Ghraib situation, and it's important. I understand President Obama's problem, and he's got other problems. on his hands, and he's trying to engineer a bipartisan policy, not too successfully thus far in respect of the economy. And obviously he knows that if he starts setting up inquiries into the conduct during the Bush administration, that's going to probably undo for certainly for his term any strong support from the Republican administration. So I'm not optimistic that anything will happen in that regard. I would like to see it, because I think it's important for two reasons. Firstly, the victims of any criminal conduct are entitled to have made public what happened to them. And more importantly, or as importantly, it's important to stop it happening in the future. And the best way to avoid it happening in the future is to let it all hang out. And the United States has supported this in other countries. The United States was one of the strongest supporters of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I'm not suggesting that anything that the United States has done compares in any way to apartheid. It doesn't. But the principle remains the same. I think it's important that the truth should be established in the interest of the victims and in the interest of the future.
Sorry, just on that point, if people are alleged to have been tortured whilst they're detained in Guantanamo, what about that is not sufficiently serious to attract the attention of the International Criminal Court?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
What if torture is alleged to have occurred?
Yes.
What is it about that that's not sufficiently serious to attract
well, the Rome Statute provides that the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction only over the most serious, egregious crimes, such as genocide and crimes against humanity. And individual acts of torture, certainly if it was proven to be general United States policy to torture thousands of people, that would be a matter for the International Criminal Court. But the allegations certainly don't reach anything near that level. So it's a question of seriousness.
There's a question right at the back, and then I think we'll just come forward.
I was wondering, you talked about the gradual growth of the international criminal law, and I was interested to what extent you think that might stymie political solutions to these problems. You gave the last example of Sudan. If, say, the person is arrested and it becomes a question of doing it right or wrong, does it harden the political realities in that country and maybe delay the introduction in country human rights?
Sorry, sir, could it?
Question was about the issue of sort of peace versus justice, that mm-hmm. An indictment against al-Bashir could hinder peace efforts.
Right. Well, thank you for raising the peace and justice issue, because it's one of the arguments that I didn't have time to mention. One of the arguments put up against the International Criminal Court and was put up against the Yugoslavia tribunal as well, that if you indict people during the war, particularly, it's going to make negotiating peace more difficult. Let me immediately concede it could. There's no question that indicting a war criminal who's running a country could well inhibit peace, because the leader may say, "What's in it for me? If I make peace, I'm going to end up in the Hague on trial, and spend the rest of my days in a prison somewhere, and I'd rather go on fighting." That's the argument. Well, it could happen. So far, it hasn't. The indictments of war criminals so far have had the opposite effect. And one doesn't know. When I issued the indictment against Radovan Karadzic in April 1995, the war was raging in the former Yugoslavia. The Secretary General, Butros Gardi, told me, and I talked about this at lunch today, he was furious with me for indicting Karadzic during the war. He said, "You should have consulted me." And he made it clear that he would advise me not to issue the indictment. And I said to him, I was very happy that I didn't consult him. little did I know, that later that year, Ambassador Holbrooke, would convene a meeting at Dayton, Ohio, to bring an end to the war, which it did. Now, had Kovacic not been indicted earlier that year, there would have been no meeting at Dayton, because in the intervening months, there was the terrible massacre of over 8,000 innocent men and boys in Srebrenica, organized by Kovacic and his army leader, General Mladic, who is still on the loose. There is no possible way that the leaders of Bosnia would have met at Dayton with Karadzic. They wouldn't have been seen in the same room as Karadzic, and they made that clear. Made it clear to me privately, and they made it clear publicly. The fact that he was indicted meant he couldn't go to Dayton. The Americans would have promptly arrested him. So the fact that he couldn't go there made Dayton possible. He was forced to accept representation, ironically, by Milosevic, and the peace agreement was entered into. So there the indictment aided peace. It was the same argument was raised against my successor, Louise Arbour, who indicted Milosevic, still during the war, and the same argument was raised. It made no difference. It was, and I know from personal discussions with the former Prime Minister of Russia, Viktor Chernomyrdin, and the former President of Finland, Martti Ahtisaari, who negotiated the peace after the NATO bombing in 1999, and they both said that Milosevic never raised the indictment against him. And he didn't raise it because he didn't take it seriously. He didn't say, I'm not going to accept the NATO conditions. So it can work both ways. The indictments in the Sudan, the indictments against the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda have apparently helped. It's brought home to war criminals that the world's watching them. So my own view is that one must accept the possibility that there can be a cost. But I think what the international community, what all governments have to decide, is whether we are a better world with international criminal justice or without international criminal justice. If we are a better world with international criminal justice, the cost may be a conflict, in some cases a contradiction between peace and justice. If that's the price we have to pay, I believe it's worth it.
Thank you. We get to the end with not so much time left, but of course I want to touch on the big issue, the Palestine-Israeli conflict. I'm aware that there's a dearth of sign-up in that region of the world, both on the Arab side and from the Israeli side. Do you think that's something that we're likely to see? Because from my perspective, to end the culture of impunity in the region, someone has to sign up to something.
Well, I think it's highly unlikely that the International Criminal Court will find that it has jurisdiction. The issue is whether the Palestinian Authority is a nation. Only governments have the right to request the International Criminal Court to investigate. The Palestinian Authority has. I also saw the report. The prosecutor's office has said that it's investigating whether in international law the Palestinian Authority has reached the level of being regarded as a government. I think it's highly unlikely. I would be very surprised if the judges decide that it has jurisdiction. Let me add that I would be fully supportive, and I have publicly supported, an independent United Nations inquiry into war crimes committed in the Gaza campaign on both sides. I think for the same reasons I gave for investigating what has happened in the United States. I think it applies. It's even more important because it's more serious and it's a more fraught area in the Middle East. But there's no substitute for making the truth public.
There's one at the back there, and then I think there was one more.
Could you please comment on the debate within the United Nations and international human rights organisations about the crime of aggression? And the context of whether the National Criminal Court and international criminal law will extend its mandate to cover that, given there's a legal conception of, you know, victims' justice, where Sudan and Serbia may be targets of the ICC, but others engaged in crime and aggression aren't, particularly in the context of Iraq and so on.
Well, again, I think a very important question, and thank you for raising it. To go back for a moment, at Nuremberg, the first offence charged against the Nazi leaders was the crime of aggression, or as it was often called in those days, the crimes against peace. And the Nazi leaders who were found guilty of that crime of aggression were on that count, almost all who were sentenced to death were found guilty and given the death sentence for waging an aggressive war. And of course, in the case of Nazi Germany, it was easy. Hitler was so obviously the aggressor. His attacks on Czechoslovakia and Poland and all the rest of it made it clear. It was all on one side. And when the International Criminal Court came to be looked at and the Rome Treaty started to be written, there were many countries that wanted to include the crime of aggression. Now, incidentally, in the case of the Yugoslavia Tribunal in Rwanda, well, it wouldn't apply in Rwanda because that was an internal affair, but in the case of the former Yugoslavia, the Security Council decided, I think wisely, not to include the crime of aggression. I would have been horrified as the prosecutor to have to deal in the former Yugoslavia with a crime of aggression. When do you start counting? The Serbs would have you start counting in 1389 at the Battle of Kosovo. With more justification, they would want to start counting in the Second World War, when hundreds of thousands of Serbs were slaughtered by the Croatian Ustasha who supported Hitler. When do you start looking? Do you only start at the end when it's the last of a cycle of violence? In Rwanda, where do you start? Over a century, there were fighting between Hutu and Tutsi. I had enough problems on my hands without having to decide in the former Yugoslavia who was the aggressor, because in my book, it's not a simple legal question. It's a political question. It's a question of history and so on. So I was very happy, and I wouldn't be unhappy for that reason, to see no agreement being reached next year when the International Criminal Court, when the Assembly of States Parties, has to decide on aggression. They couldn't agree in 1998, mainly because they couldn't get agreement on what aggression means. How do you define aggression? And it was certainly freedom fighters said, we not aggressors, we fighting for the freedom of our country, and that caused problems. And so they kicked for touch, which is an expression I can use in Australia, can't in America. And they said, well, we'll put it off for 9 years, and we'll decide 9 years after the treaty comes into force. 7 years after the treaty comes into force, which would be this year, but they've postponed it to 2010 to see if they can agree on a definition of aggression. One of the chief arguments against incorporating aggression is that it's a matter for the Security Council. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. It's a political decision who the aggressor is, and if the Security Council makes a decision, then it can be referred to the International Criminal Court. It shouldn't just be for the prosecutor's office and the judges to decide. So these are some of the fairly complex arguments, and as I say, I wouldn't personally lose any sleep if they don't reach agreement next year. The Cambodia Tribunal. Well, again, it's consistent with the view I've expressed. I think even if it's late, rather late than never, the crimes committed by the Khmer Rouge are some decades ago. A lot of the victims have died in the interim. Pol Pot has died in the interim, and the most senior leader now, Duk. Is being put on trial. My information is he's probably going to plead guilty and apologise and show remorse and so on. Well, I think that's important. I think it's very important for well over a million people were slaughtered by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and why shouldn't the truth come out at this stage? Of course, there are huge problems. In the way of that tribunal, the Cambodian government has been playing, has been hot and cold. It's been on and off in setting it up, and It's a very complicated tribunal. They're local Cambodian judges, they're foreign judges, and they're two prosecutors with equal power, and they have to agree on everything they do, otherwise they can't do it. So it's a difficult situation. The beginning of the trial has been postponed and postponed. But in principle, I think it's a good idea. It's already very late in the day for doing a good job.
I think we might bring things to a close. I thought I might finish by trying to give a brief summary of Justice Goldstone's presentation tonight. He went through three keys to the development, and the very recent development, really, of international criminal law: the development of the concept of crimes against humanity, universal jurisdiction, and international human rights law. It wasn't until 1993 when we saw our first international criminal courts with the International Criminal Tribunals for Yugoslavia and then Rwanda, which left several legacies and will continue to, because they're still going. That is that international criminal tribunals can work. They're not perfect, but they can work. They were very important for the development of the law, for example, the law of the Genocide Convention, the Geneva Conventions, and especially in the area of gender-based atrocities. And finally, a legacy regarding the ending of impunity, which has had important knock-on effects for notorious tyrants such as General Pinochet, Suharto, Mengistu, Charles Taylor, Slobodan Milosevic, and now Radovan Karadzic. It's culminated in the creation of a permanent international criminal court in 1998, which came online in 2002 and now has 108 states parties. It's investigating four situations and now conducting its first trial. And from tomorrow, it seems that we're going to get an indictment of a sitting head of state, President al-Bashir, in the Sudan. And Justice Goldstone finished off on the optimistic note that with political will, for example, the new attitude of the United States with the new administration, but even with the old administration in the last few years, international criminal justice can work. Okay, that brings formal proceedings to an end. First, let me thank you all for coming out on a very, very windy night in Melbourne. And I will ask you to please join us for some drinks, which are out in the foyer, just this way, on the way out. Let me thank Holding Redlich again for making this evening possible. So thanks, Holding Redlich, and thanks, Andrea. And please, can you all join me in thanking our speaker tonight, Justice Goldstone.